What a privilege to be a part of something like this. 20 years ago, when I started my journey, or we did, there was nothing like this. And we hunted libraries for books, and you'd find one little half of a chapter on adopting transracially. And you'd find very little resources. I had two phone friends who had walked a little bit further in the journey than I. And she became dear, dear close friends who were able to help us in our journey. I have one husband and eight children. As I said, our ages are 6, 8, 15, 17, 18, 22, 25, and 28. My 28-year-old's married and has four children, so I have four grandbabies, and they are delightful, although I'm still doing the same thing, and so we become more like girlfriends than we do mother-daughter, and I forget to be a grandma sometimes, and she forgets that she's the big sister to mine, and my little girls love their nieces and nephews, and it's the best of both worlds for all of us. It really is. My daughter Ruthie is just got married, and her husband's an attorney, and so that's the wedding picture. We finally had one that we all look pretty good, because Christmas pictures don't work in our family because it's too many kids. Anyway, and then my boys at home, or I have a son, Theo, who's 22 and in Haiti as we speak, on his way home from a two-week trip there with Haiti Orphan Relief Team. I did the same thing, and I thought I was locked out. Anyway, and so he's in Haiti and had an incredible life-changing experience there. Their goal is to partner churches here with churches there and somehow adopt one another in family and care for the churches there, which is a really beautiful picture. And then I have the three boys, teenage boys, that are 15, 17, and 18, and pretty much they've driven me to drink. I'm at Southern, but they all said things up front that weren't appropriate, so that's my one thing. And they are the life of the party. They're great kids, and we're learning a lot. And then we have two little girls that are 6 and 8 that keep us young. Everybody tells us that will keep us young, and so we're believing them in our process. My story is a little bit personal, but hopefully you'll find yourself somewhere in the journey and find yourself a place of hearing God speak to you. And I'd encourage you to write down questions so we can talk a little bit afterwards. I probably am going to say nothing new under the sun, except that God takes the mess of our lives and redeems it for his glory and purpose, which is always a great story. The gospel is always a great story. I'm going to spend some time on my story, then I'm going to talk about specifically transracial adoption, and then I'm going to talk about just adoption in general, and then I'll field some questions from there. I'm from Minnesota. I go to Bethlehem Baptist Church. I have been directing the MICA Fund, which is a minority infant child adoption financial help for families, for about 20 years, and we've helped about 300 babies be placed in Christian homes. It's been a delightful journey. Half the reason I love this kind of thing is I love meeting families who are entering the journey of adoption and kind of walking with them. Everybody has a God story to tell. If you haven't started journaling, you should, because this will be a God story. It will be, and you will enjoy it. Oh, can I hold him? Her? Oh, okay. Anyway, and so I encourage you in those regards. I also serve on the board of the Christian Alliance for Orphans. We're having another conference very similar to this in Minneapolis, April 29 and 30. How many of you have heard of it? We'd love to see you in Minneapolis. It's going to be more of the same. We're actually offering HAG hours, classes for your adoption process. That'd be a helpful thing. My pastor, John Piper, will be preaching. Stephen Curtis will be singing. And so we'd love to see you there or invite friends and family who might be in the Minneapolis area. We would love to serve them any way we could. April 29 and 30, I can guarantee it won't be freezing, but I can't guarantee anything else. So you might want to check the weather before you come. One year it was 80 and another year it was 30. So, you know, we just don't know. I met my wonderful husband in Lake Tahoe, California. We were both on a mission trip, suffering for Jesus, in the beautiful town of Lake Tahoe. Our goal was to come together from students across the country to learn how to grow in our faith, how to live it out, flesh it out, have a job, and learn how to share a faith. And And we had a blast. One of the things I love about my husband is he was determined to let the world know that being a Christian was never boring. And so we have many stories of him making sure it wasn't boring. And then he married me, and of course, you know, that tells the whole story. Anyway, and during that time, we became really good friends, and our heart's desire was to serve the Lord in full-time Christian work. And so that's how I chose him, and he chose me, and we wanted to do it together. And so the deal was we got engaged shortly after that summer, and the parents said, you got to wait till Mary Dell graduates to get married, you know, and you got to have all your ducks in a row. So he went off to full-time Christian work, and I was still finishing college as a music major. And in that process of trying to figure out and navigate being engaged and long distance, we struggled to stay sexually pure. And we were very aware of friends and family who'd botched up a lot of relationships and trust, and how that can really break up a marriage long term. And yet found ourselves in that situation, and when asked for help, you know, we were leaders of our Christian movement in that time, and people would kind of go, oh, you guys are the leaders, it'll be okay, God will be with you. And we would say, no, we really need help. And at the end of the day, found ourselves pregnant and shamed and feeling guilty and feeling like, well, you know, we just goofed up. And you go, oh, wow, what a mess. Went to the student union to get my little pregnancy test at Northwestern University, and they said, you're pregnant, and here's where you get an abortion. And I said, wow, I'm engaged. I know, but you wouldn't want to give up your future, all this time and school, and you're at this prestigious university. Certainly, there's better ways to plan. And so I said, no, thank you. I'm engaged to be married, and we'll figure this out. And so I left school, and we moved to Minneapolis, and my husband was asked to leave full-time Christian work by the organization he was with. That was painful. That was hard. And in that journey, though, as we get asked for help and coming around, people coming around us, you know, we really begged God's forgiveness. And I personally really experienced that I'd made a mistake, but God was loving me and carrying me through this time. My husband, on the other hand, felt like God will never use me again. And I might as well resign myself to the fact of the basic American job. And so we got married and had our first baby. She was a little girl, and you learn to rejoice and that she was the gift that God had planned. We didn't understand all of that at the time. But my husband pushed himself into full-time running the American dream. Let's see how much money I can make and how fast I can do it and how many jobs I can create or not create, and company cars and all that sort of thing. And we walked with God. We went to church, but he was hurting. And it affected our marriage, affected our parenting. And we had another little girl, and boy, we had this perfect little family, you know, two kids, everything's good. And I said to my husband one day, what if we could have a son? And some guys care, some guys don't, right? And he said, God would never give me the desire of my heart. And I said, but what if he did? Well, he just would never do that. And so I started praying, and you know, as women only can, to manipulate situations. And, and so, you know, about a year later, we had our son, Theo. And it was one of those God moments in our lives where God again said to my husband, I still love you. And I still desire to give you the desire of your heart. And I put that desire there because I know you and I created you. And so it began a journey of healing in his heart. And then he said, we are done having children. I do not want any surprises. He had been the product of a huge surprise 15 years later, you know, and all those things. And it was just terrible. And so he did the whole vasectomy thing, the V word. I was very unhappy. I was very nervous that we were taking God's will and, you know, goofing up life. But I said, if there's always the opportunity that maybe we could adopt. And, of course, he was willing to sign on to anything to get rid of the situation. So we had our perfect little family, our two girls and our one little boy. And my little son was very relational, verbal kid, smart as a whip. And finally one day I said, honey, Ted needs a brother. And he said, no, And I said, you know, it's not possible. And I said, well, what about, you know, adoption? And he's like, no, we have a perfect little happy family. And about that time, a good friend of mine, we were at their house, and she said, my sister adopted from India last year, and they just got a call about a baby, and they asked the question, would you be willing to take a baby that had brown skin like your Indian daughter, but kinky hair, because it's an African-American baby? And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. There's babies in America that can be adopted? And she said, well, that's what they said, and there's this baby waiting in Georgia. And I was like, you've got to be kidding. I, in my time during college in Chicago, had spent a large part of my time singing in an all-black gospel choir. I was the one and only white girl in the choir. And my closest friends in our Bible study were African-American women. And so this was just news to me. I was so curious. And about that same time, you probably all don't even remember this, but there was a pro-life movement where people were getting put in jail for standing at the abortion clinics. And we were in the car listening to Dr. Dobson, and they were talking about abortion and people going to jail. And my little girl, Ruthie, said, what's that? You know, what's abortion? I'm trying to explain the crisis of a woman and not having help and sometimes feeling that there was no other way. And in her little five-year-old mind, she said, Mommy, couldn't we help her? Couldn't we take her baby so she wouldn't have to kill it? And so we, of course, that was, you know, ammunition I could take home to my husband, you know. And so we kind of started our wheels turning. And in the meantime, I called the social worker to say, is it really true that there are black babies here in America that don't have homes? And she said, you know, Mary Dell, here in America, if you're a black woman and you're in crisis pregnancy and you decide not to parent and you want Christian help or any kind of help, really, there's no place for you to go where you can be assured that your baby will get a family, because families aren't waiting in line for black babies. And so they're considered special needs purely because of the color of their skin. And I was like, you have got to be kidding. And so she said, lots of families are doing it. It's becoming a new, we've got a wonderful Christian woman in Atlanta, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, who's helping. And so that's the story. Well, I went home to my husband immediately because now I had a plan. And I wanted Ted to have a brother, and I wanted a parent. And he kept saying, Mary Dell, we don't have money. We don't have, you know, house space. We don't have anything. And so then I had to analyze my heart. What was my goal? What really was driving me? And what I realized was that, A, this had to come from God, because I'm a really selfish person. And all of my girlfriends were getting new furniture or a new car, or, you know, putting their little girls in the best clothes possible. And all I was asking for was for another baby, which was going to cost me everything, especially my sleep. And so anyway, I said that to my husband. I just said, I don't get this. I don't know what this is about. And one day he came home from work and said, God told me at the stop sign in Belle Plaine, Minnesota, that I'm supposed to put down my will and choose his way. So let's start and see what God does. And he said, what if we just say that any unexpected income that comes our way, we'll assume is for adoption? I'm like, that is a good idea. So within 2 days, he calls home. And he has worked at the same place for 25 years. This has never happened before. It has never happened since. But he walked into his office, and there on his desk was an envelope from his boss. And it said, Dear Bruce, just want to thank you for all your hard work. And I was like, so he calls me and says, you're never going to believe what just happened. And I said, well, how much is it for? Like, you know, he said, well, it's $100. And I said, well, that'll be enough to start the process. And by the way, I've been saving grocery money, so we really have a little bit more to start the home study. And so we moved forward, just really not knowing what God was going to do, but knowing that we were going to have a baby. And through that process, had a couple, three or four fall throughs where we thought we were going to baby, and we weren't going to baby, and birth moms changed their mind, children ended up hurt and abused, and parents were making poor choices. It was a time of breaking, a time of preparation. But there we were getting ready for this prop. And in the process, we heard about an organization called the Micah Fund, and they wanted to give us some money. Now, guys, listen up, because this is always the guy's issue. You know, money, have to have it. and to pay for this. And the microphone said, we want to give you some money for your adoption. And my husband was like, well, we can pay it back. We'll make it a loan. No, we really want to give you money for your adoption. And it was so hard for him to receive that idea, but we were just so thrilled and in the process. And sure enough, on my birthday, June 5th, 1991, we got a phone call. And Phoebe, my good friend, called and said, there's been a baby boy. Are you interested? And I'm like, it's my birthday! Of course I'm interested! And just so happened, she said, I'll overnight you the information. Picture this, there's no email, there's no faxing, there's none of that stuff where you get instant information. And I realized after I'd hung up with her that we had moved and she didn't know the new address, so she was mailing it all to the old address, 30 miles away. So I called my old neighbor and I said, I will be over tomorrow morning to sit on your step, and waited for that picture to come. And she sat there with me. Couldn't believe that we were doing this crazy thing. People thought we were crazy. Our parents thought we were crazy. You already have three children. How will you afford college? How will you afford the grocery bill? Yada, yada, yada. And anyway, so the man came, the postman, and I was in such a hurry to get this picture that I raced down this steep driveway and fell head over heels, scraped both knees, my chin, everything was bleeding, and I'm holding this envelope with my picture. And it was not a very good picture. It was like a Polaroid. I was so disappointed. But he was ours. He was our son. We knew he would be. And shortly thereafter, my daughter and I, 11 years old, took a trip to Atlanta to pick him up. And back in those days, you could go to the airport and meet people at the gate. And so we got back to Minneapolis. And my husband had always worried, could I really love a child not birthed of me? And he's not what I'd call like a lovey-dovey, warm, fuzzy kind of guy. He's a really, really nice guy. Everybody likes him, but he's just not really. And so he was worried. But he trusted God and like, I'm willing to jump off this cliff. Mary Dell's coming with me and it'll be cool. You know, remember, Christians never have boring lives. Remember that. And so anyway, as sure as I'm standing here today, ladies and gentlemen, I got off that airplane. Oh, that's a good reminder. Are you sure you don't need me to hold him? And I placed our son Joshua in my husband's hands. And in that moment, my six-week-old baby looked up at my husband and smiled, grabbed his finger, and God spoke to my husband. And I wish he were here to say it. Bruce, this is how I love you. This is how you know I have chose you before the foundation of the world, and you are mine. There is nothing you could ever do that would stop me from loving you. There is no sin that could ever cause me to not want to move towards you, and you are mine, not because anything you've ever done, because I choose you. And a miracle happened in my husband's life. For the first time in his life, he really felt forgiven of all that 10 years of guilt and shame. And my husband fell in love with Joshua Paul Sandberg. Almost to a problem. It was like, honey, you have other children here. They need your attention. They can actually talk, and this one can't. He can be ignored a little bit. It was a beautiful time in our lives. Because God, the God of relationship, the God of love and mercy, it became a visible display to my husband and myself of this is who our God is. You know, people come to these kind of things and I go, of course you'd want to adopt. Of course you'd have that desire. Why? Because your father is an adopting father. And as you reflect him, of course you're his child. What a glorious thing that he gives us that opportunity to join him. You know, many, many times my kids beg to go to work with daddy. And, you know, I'm too busy. But the very rare times when he lets them go with, it's such a treat. Our father invites us along on the journey. And so that really was a turning point in our lives. God used a little baby boy to redeem tons of pain in our lives and the guilt that came with it. And shortly thereafter, my husband said, we have to do this again. Like, we're in it for the long haul, and Josh needs a brother. We knew we didn't want him to be the only adopted child in our family. We knew we didn't want him to be the only black child if possible. That's Marydale's gospel. That isn't the gospel, but I really highly recommend that you consider making sure they're not alone, even if there's multiple children. They don't want to be the only one. And so we were found ourselves a year later on our way down to Arkansas. And the judge had never done a transracial adoption before, the judge they had picked for this adoption. And so we went by faith, wondering whether God would actually come through in this. And of course, we named him Daniel because God is our judge. And that judge was very curious why any white family would want to take this black baby into their home in Arkansas. And we literally drove down, picked him up, and drove back to Minnesota. And our lives were good, and our lives were full, and God was about making us a family. It didn't come without bumps, though. The spiritual dynamic of adoption has to be addressed, and that the enemy loses when a woman doesn't abort. And then he loses again when a child is placed in a Christian home. But he's not ready to give up. And so you need to walk this journey very aware of what's happening and very aware of the spiritual dynamics in your own family, and be prayerful and careful in those days. I do remember a very dark day having five kids and walking around the block with my husband, and he said, I don't want to be here anymore. You know? And I'm so glad he did, in the sense that we were able to talk it through. He didn't wait until he was in so much pain that he left us. It was hard, but God brought us through it. And about 2 years later, we were on vacation. Actually, we were at a funeral. My grandfather died. And got another phone call. By the way, we've been getting phone calls like once every other week. Do you know anybody who'll take a brown baby? Anybody. And so we had this whole little gathering of family and friends who were adopting, and it was kind of crazy. There was a phone call in the message saying, there's a little boy who doesn't have a home. Thought of your family. What do you think? And by the time we called Monday morning after 4th of July, they'd already found another family. But it was just enough to stir in our hearts to go, Lord, we were like ready. We didn't know we were ready, but like when the call came, something was stirring. And so we called our social worker and she said, well, let's at least get you updated so that if something else happens. And 2 weeks later, I called that agency, which has now become a good friend because of all the transactions we'd accomplished. and she said, funny you would call. 2 weeks have passed, and that family that was going to take this baby decided he was too dark. And so he's waiting for a mom and daddy. And so he became our Isaac, since we had put him on the altar and God had given him back to us. And we went down to Georgia, and we decided to go. It was Sunday morning. We received him, and we're at a southern city in Georgia, and decided to go to church there with her, all-white church, and she asked the pastor would pray over our child. So this meant the white couple with the black baby was going to get up on the stage in front of this whole congregation of southern folks and be prayed for. And right before we walk up, she goes, you are rocking the boat. And sure enough, it was one of those glorious moments of God, again, just revealing himself that I've called you. I know what's going on. There's no mistakes in my book. And Isaac became ours. And we thought we were done. Everything was great. We had six kids. We were very, very, very busy. And my husband works out of our home, so that helped. We could work together and parent and all those things. And my sister really got the wing to adopt. And so they wanted a boy. They had three girls, and they wanted a boy. And I said, the only way to be sure is to adopt. You know, if you try and birth another baby, you might get another girl. And so she'd gone through my girlfriend Phoebe, and paperwork was done. And lo and behold, I get a phone call saying, there's a woman in labor, and she's going to have a baby boy, and we can't find your sister anywhere. What's happened to her? And I said, oh, Phoebe, she moved. Here's her new phone number. And we chatted, and she said, by the way, if this is a girl, I'm bringing her to you. And we laughed hard. And the next day she called and said, Marydale, it was a girl. And I said, that's nice. Do you want me to find a family? And she said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, Bruce would never go for it. So, you know, whatever. And she said, well, how about if I send you the file? And so I told Bruce this, and he said, look, Mary Dale, we're already crazy. People already think we're off the... We've lost a lot of friends by this point in time because we're just a little too much on the edge. Large family. Everybody's moved on to other things. And so we decide we're not telling anybody. He goes in a room, reads the file. I go in another room, read the file separately. And it was like, okay, either we both say yes or it doesn't happen. We're not going to discuss this. God's going to have to show up. And so we read the little file about her life and her past and her birth mom's crisis and the pain. And we both looked at each other and went, man, we're old. Could we at least do the math together, you know? And it's like, okay, so we'll be 61 when she graduates from high school, and or 60, something like that. And and we did have comfort because there was other people in our lives who had, as a matter of fact, at Bethlehem, Pastor John adopted at 48 or 49. So the joke is, until you're that old, it's all open game. You have to be willing, you know? And so... Anyway, all that to say, we went to our kids and said, you know, what do you think? And our one son said, Mom, just think, the evangelist in our house, if the six kids we have right now, if in our whole lives, each of us helps 10 people know Jesus better, that's 60 people. And what if those 60 people in their whole entire life help 10 more people know Jesus? You know, and you start doing the math, it doesn't take very long. And he goes, and by the way, Mom, I'm going to be an evangelist. So thousands will be, you know, put my number in thousands, it'll be thousands. And so then we had to make a decision about when to pick her up. And God, you know, we still didn't tell anybody. Like, we just went and did it because we're like, people will, you know, write us off for good. So right before we left, though, we sat him each down to say, we're going to take a legal risk. We've never done this before, but we're going to go and take her and bring her home, and there's a chance that we'd have to bring her back. And so we got to our 9-year-old son, Josh, who was our first adopted. You saw his gorgeous picture in there, didn't you, by the way, how gorgeous they all are? Anyway, and he looked at me and he said, Mommy, wouldn't it have been better to know her and love her for just a day than to never have known her at all? And you just go, okay, we're on the journey. And so we went to get her in the middle of the night, did our little transactions, picked her up, brought her home. And wow, that was a big change for us to start all over again. My only claim to fame is that I've been potty training for 25 years. And I finally just finished. And I still haven't figured it out, so I'm not going to write a book on that subject. Every child brought their own challenges and unique personalities to the table. Anyway, and so there we were, but I realized that I was much older and I didn't want to play dolls and tea parties. And so the relational person that I am, I said to my husband, she needs a sister. And he said, no, honey, she has two sisters and they will come over and play tea with her any day of the week. And I said, honey, they're 20. They're not a baby, and or 18 and 20, whatever they were. And so we kind of just, you know, went on with life, and life was busy. And lo and behold, Phoebe called Bruce one day and said, Bruce, what you doing? He said, I'm driving down the freeway, Phoebe, how you doing? And this wasn't uncommon for her to call him. They were good friends as well. And so she said, Bruce, you probably need to pull over. And he said, no, Phoebe, I'm on this boring highway. It'll be just fine. Well, you probably need to pull over. And he said, Grace's birth mom's with me, and she's pregnant again, and wondering if you'll take her baby. And so my honey came home, and he said, guess what? We're pregnant. And so there's our journey of ups and downs, of the reality of life being lived in the context of adoption. No. Now that I have grandchildren, did you see the grandchildren in the picture? They're beautiful as well. And I am passionate about the idea that I can just help a whole bunch of people make a difference. You should never say never about anything with God. We don't know his ways. But it's just been an incredible, incredible journey of watching God at work. And you see, you almost get addicted because he so faithfully opens doors and closes doors. The story this morning was so beautiful. By chance, Ruth ended up here. And by chance, nothing is by chance. Our God is so faithful at wherever you're at in this journey, and he is so willing to show his children the way. He doesn't make mistakes. We think they're mistakes. We think they're inconveniences. But he's so good about that. So I want to spend a little time about race and a little time about adoption in itself. Racism is alive and well. How many of you are from the South? Most of you? How many are from the North? Oh, probably half and half. Good deal. Minnesota's Minnesota nice. People don't hate you in front of you. They hate you behind your back. And my problem is that they start out as cute bundles of joy, brown little kissable cheek kind of thing, and they turn into beautiful, gorgeous men. And every woman in the high school wants a piece of them. You know, so we're dealing with a lot of that kind of stuff. But along the journey, it's been a fascinating thing to be a white mama with black babies, because most people don't know they're my kids. We spent a lot of time with our kids in a private school in another community. So we've just now started it's been 3 years of public school, high school stuff, where we're actually engaged in our community at a deeper level. And so I've been able to have the privilege of sitting in the bleachers, watching my son play ball and have people comment, you know, about this awesome player out there. And I can go, that's my son. But I've also had the privilege of hearing the stupid things people say. You know, whether it's, oh, look at him dance on stage. He's, you know, those black people, they just got all that rhythm. And so to the point where even people who know that I have black children, if they're not with me, will say silly things, like the principal of the school. I was concerned because our kids, one of our children, really, this is the honest truth, he's an incredible athlete, and the teachers had written him off as a dumb black jock. That was it. And they really didn't care about him and was happy that he was getting C's and D's. And I was not happy. And so I was trying to explain this to my principal, which she and I, you know, I kind of have made myself the mama bear of all mama bears. And so I was advocating for my child. And she said, well, you know, Mary Dell, we've got this new government grant now, and it's to help diversify our school. And, you know, those kids who we're trying to help, we're actually going to have a special curriculum for them because they are going to have a hard time getting into college without these special classes for them. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you saying what I think you're saying, that all black kids are dumb when you have to have special curriculum? And I mean, I didn't say that to her. Everything within me wanted to say that to her. And you don't hear it unless you've walked it. You know, for 20 years, I go to the grocery store by myself. I never get carded. I bring my kids with to the grocery store. We've been to the same grocery store for some 15 years. I get carded with my kids. Okay? The bank, just this last week, this was terrible. I do this to scare you. I don't do this to scare you. I say, wake up and smell the coffee, because it really exists. My son got 2 ATM cards in the mail. And he couldn't remember which, because one was under my name, and now that he's 18, he wanted his own account. So he couldn't remember which card was which. So I said, why don't you just stop by the bank and ask him? So he brings in his cards by himself. And the lady assumes that he'd stolen them from somewhere. Because he said, I can't remember which card is for which account. You know, he didn't know for sure. Of course, he hadn't kept his paperwork right, all those things that he should have done. And they shredded his cards, both of them. And of course, then the mama bear had to go in with him and say, this is my son. What did just happen? Really? Did this really just happen? And so the more we can give them voice to their experience, you don't talk like a black person. What's wrong with you? My son looks at him and goes, excuse me? I talk like an English person with an English education. Thank you very much. You know? Or the other son who likes to look like the ghetto rap. He's a rap star. He thinks he's going to be a rap star. you know, I'm like, honey, you're giving them all the ammunition. You know, the media is out there. They paint a picture, and you've got to combat it at every level. And so we've had a fun journey with that. Be aware. Advocate for your child. Teach them to advocate for themselves. Read everything you can find. There's some good stuff out there. In Their Own Voices is a tale of adult adoptees who have journeyed. That's helpful. It's kind of depressing and helpful. It's real life hurt and pain, loss and grief. But you have to put it in the context of without Jesus, who has hope? You know, so you're going to read stories of people who aren't coming from necessarily that context as well. My friend Phoebe always says, and she's an African-American woman, the truth is we are raising Jesus followers. We are raising children who follow Christ, which means they will be a minority, whether they're black or white. And they need to learn to stand alone in our culture. It's just a little more difficult when you're also dealing with the issues of race. But that needs to be our primary focus, is Christian. And family. Family. Every child wants to belong. The greatest need in the world is to belong to a family. Work hard at building a family that promotes that sort of connections that last. Again, it's all about adoption and relationship. You know, God calls us to himself, not just to put us on a pedestal so we can display his wonderful little children. He does it so he can be in relationship with us. And finally, adoption is not a project. It is not a mission. If you want a mission project, go to China. And if you don't like it, you can come home. Okay? Adoption is about parenting and about lavishly loving someone else in the universe and giving your life to one another. It's a true picture of God and his relationship to us. He doesn't need us. He chooses us. And every orphan in the world does not need you. Our Father has already promised that he himself will be the father to the fatherless. Sometimes he uses us. Sometimes he doesn't. And that's okay because God knows what he's doing. So any point in there where you're feeling, there's a craze right now. You know, if the pastor does it, everybody in the church wants to do it because it's the right thing to do. Everybody wants to be right. I don't know how I feel about that, but think hard and long before you do that. So if you want to be extravagant, loving, relationship, then you're up for parenthood. If you want a project, like I said, China, Africa, anywhere you want to go would be really good. So God takes our mess. He takes all of our choices. Don't worry about making mistakes. Don't worry about the things that, you know, I already own the World's Worst Parent Award. Did I already tell you that? I might have told the other group that. So you don't have to worry about getting it because I already own it, okay? My kids have made it very clear that I'm the world's worst mother. Anyway, it's all about the gospel. It's about the freedom to be forgiven, the freedom to walk in holiness in a way that makes a difference in our culture. And we can love because he first loved us. Otherwise, this will never, never work. And finally, you know, we're all caught up in this pure and undefiled religion is this, to care for widows and orphans in their distress. What's the second half of the verse? And keep yourself unstained from the world. Folks, a lot of us in Christian America have spent a lot of time trying to keep clean. Bible study and prayer and making sure our kids go to Christian school or don't see bad TV or whatever it is, because we're so worried about being clean, unstained from this terrible world, when maybe the recipe for holiness is right there in caring for widows and orphans in their distress. Because I promise you, if you're busy either parenting adopted kids or pouring your life out for the orphan, you aren't going to have any time to get materialistic. You know, I don't have time to go to the store and buy a new pair of jeans, folks. I mean, it's really that bad, but that good. It's freeing because you're giving your life away for something that's so much bigger than you are. I mean, in God's cosmic craziness, sometimes you wonder, did he just create this crisis to wake us up for our good? So we wouldn't be so self-centered and so self-focused. So the question becomes not whether you're going to adopt or not, because not everybody's called to adopt, but everybody's called to care. How will you love? How will you love well? What will you do? Will it be the widow? Will it be the orphan? What's it going to look like? How are you going to love? How are you going to advocate for the orphan? Are you going to be the voice? Are you going to be the skin that Jesus calls us to be, hands and feet? Very shortly, Monday, I fly to Africa. And I've been a couple, three times. This time I'm going to Uganda. But in a previous trip, I went to Zambia. And we spent our time at a Christian school of orphans, and we were told to bring them home at the end of the day. And so we took a little girl by the hand and walked her to her village. A mile and a half down the road, it was scorching hot, but don't worry, I had my shades and I had my bottle of water. And I got to her little home, and she had nothing. She had no water. She had no food. She had three times too many people living in this little hut. And it wasn't really her mama. It was her cousin's auntie or someone like that. It was very dry, very hot. And I said, Jesus, maybe you're not enough, because this crisis is way too much. Really? I mean, the joy of the Lord, really, right here? And immediately, he said, Mary Dell, this is who you are apart from me. You are starving. You are thirsty. You are needy. And I will give you what you need. You don't ever forget those kind of moments in life. And to the extent that we bring ourselves close to the orphan is the extent that we begin to identify the glory of the gospel, the glory of our redemption in a God who loves and delights in taking our mess and using it, mixing it all up in the pot and going, look what I did. It's an amazing thing. So I would submit to you today, we need these children far more than they need us. My son Joshua is going to graduate from high school in just a few months. And one of the things in preparation for that time is I'm planning to write him a letter. He's not had an easy journey. He's an incredibly kind, gentle man who still quite hasn't figured out the best way to deal with some of his pain and hurt. And I've learned more in the last 2 years of my life about a loving father who waits for us and who bears our burdens and who weeps for our sin and for waiting for our hearts to come back to him. A father who lavishly keeps making the bed every day, even though you're furious with your 18-year-old son, because you wait and you love no matter what. And I'm going to say, dear Joshua, I want you to know that the gift of your life to me has changed me. God has purged me and built me in ways that could never, ever have been built had I not learned about his love towards me and my fallen sinfulness. I always say to him, we all poop in the same toilet. It's all the same. It's just how we journey towards the Father that makes the difference. And so, as you leave today, know that God is for you. He has a plan. He uses all the mess. He takes the desires of your heart and surprises you in ways you can't imagine for his glory and your great joy. So live there. It might seem messy, but don't miss him in trying to be a good parent or trying to save the world. You don't need to. He's already done it. So thanks so much. Feel free to come up. I hope you haven't seen all the bad pictures in there, but you know, whatever. If you have other questions, you can Facebook. We can become Facebook friends if that would help you. Anybody have any questions?
This kind of cereal, and I'd like to eat this kind of cereal, but I mean, when did they start asking questions, and how did you answer some of those questions?
Probably, you know, Sunday school, preschool type, when people started noticing them. You know, you're different. Look at you compared to me. And we had tried to do a really good job of delighting in God's creative ability in all shades of skin and hair types, so that they were very aware that everybody was different from each other. There wasn't just one. And because our kids had, you know, my little ones especially, only know the black family. The white family's gone. I mean, the white siblings are gone. And in terms of adoption, you know, it becomes very obvious very quickly that there's a difference there. And just like anything else, you give them what they ask for at the moment of that developmental part of the journey. For a while, my one wanted to hide her skin. She wanted to wear long sleeves so people wouldn't make fun of her. But yeah.
You mentioned how the white community addressed you with your family dynamic. How did the black community,
Yeah, you know, actually, we've been very blessed. I would encourage you highly to ask God to bring people into your life, if you don't already have people in your life of color, so that it becomes a normal part of your journey. Even Christian or not Christian, like our kids had a great black basketball coach. He wasn't a follower of Jesus, but he provided a role model and a strong work ethic to our boys at a time. We haven't had any, mostly just curious, or at the end of the day, wow, I'm glad you're doing something. You know, really, what do you do if there's not? The need isn't the same as it was 20 years ago. It's politically correct now for many to adopt across racial lines. And so, but we still have agencies calling us saying, you know, is there a family? We've got a baby. Open dialogue's really helpful. There's, of course, the black families who always want to try and, you know, tell you what to do. Like, you really don't know what you're doing, and you need to be told what to do. I listened to that early in my parenting, and then I kind of blew them all off. Like, I can only handle so much. And this is the journey we're on. I, on purpose, wanted a boy, though, because I didn't want to do hair. Like, that was my main thing. I'll have a child, but I wanted a boy because I wanted to shave the head. So we're dealing with hair now with our little girls. But God has been very good to bring people into our lives, and our community is gradually becoming more diverse. And so my younger boy is having a much more healthy high school career because there's more diversity in their classes. Yep. You know, my friend Phoebe says, these are children of destiny, that God has a purpose and a plan for an adopted child that couldn't, or for whatever reason, isn't planned to be part of their birth family's culture. And that he has to, just like he did with Moses, divinely place them into your arms, so that his purposes and plan can be accomplished in your life, in their lives. And so to encourage your child that this is God's plan, this is his way of, let me say this really quick. Have I already said this? Don't say to your children, we wanted a baby so much. Have I said that? No. We wanted a baby so much and God gave us you. Isn't that awesome? That's a lot of pressure to put on a child. And it's true, but it's really not enough. It's not going to get a child through a hard time. What is going to get them through the hard times is, this is part of God's story. This is the plan he has for your life. And you're the star at this moment in this journey. And you have a destiny that God has planned before the beginning of time. And just like he planned that star to sit right there in the sky every night of the universe, he planned and purposed that you would be in my family, and I would be your mama, and you'd be my little boy. Every night when I put my little girls to bed, I say, Lord, thank you that of all the little 6 and 8-year-old girls in the entire world, who are they again? You know, is it Casey? No, mama, it's not Casey. Well, is it Amy? No, it wasn't Amy. You're right, it was you. Of all the 8-year-olds in the world, God knew that I needed you, and you needed me. And that becomes the glue. And there's been times, teenage years, where I've had to say, you know what, I know you're not happy living here. I know you wish you could live somewhere else. But you might need to talk to your Heavenly Father about that. You know, that's not easy, but sometimes that helps. So, mostly support. Very curious. So, yeah.
The issues that you've had in teenage years or are having, they attributable to being adopted or racial or just being human?
That's a very good question, because I'm so thankful that I birthed three kids and had teenage experience before I went through this. So I've been able to at least go, eh, you know, that doesn't count. You can try to use the race card here, but it won't work for me. Or, you know, poor me, I'm adopted. I'm like, you know, not in this situation, it won't work. But there is just a really strong, strong need to belong and to feel different your whole life and to be treated different is just a really hard piece that we need to give them voice to make the difference. And I think in some ways we jumped the gun on some adolescent stuff where we reacted instead of really looked at the situation and made better choices as parents. You know, we've just learned so much. If you've got parents, if you're any parent, if you're a parent of teens, Mark Gregston, anybody heard of Mark Gregston? He has an awesome email, awesome radio show, all about teens, dealing with troubled teens or parenting today's troubled teens. And he has great wisdom, great advice. He runs a group home in Texas for troubled teens. And 40% of his clients are adopted kids. And I would submit to you, he says it's because, you know, adopted kids have extra trouble. I would submit to you that's maybe partially true. They just have a different kind of trouble. But the real issue is that if you've birthed a child and you're in crisis, you own it. If you adopt a child, it's very easy in crisis to blame someone else. And so the easiest thing to blame is adoption. Oh, this must be an adoption issue, so I better go to the professional who can fix the adoption issue. Parenting on any level is a call, an invitation from God Himself for you to change. This is about pursuing holiness, folks. And we are just as much to blame as our kids many, many times. So, you know, every little bit's been a different sort of journey. Our boys aren't really into the whole, I'm adopted, I'm special. You know, girls are more likely to think about, you know, birthing a child themselves and those kind of crises in life. So, yeah. Anything else? Can I pray for all of you then before we go? Father, I'm so thankful that you have brought these people here for this day today and that you have a divine plan and purpose that's much bigger than we could ever imagine or think. And we claim in the name of Jesus for you to provide a way and make it clear for each family here what the next steps are. God, we thank you that you are a loving Father who lavishes his love on us, that you do not withhold anything from blessing us and protecting us and keeping us and defending us. And Father, we're so thankful for your Father heart towards us. Would you give us hearts that want to reflect that to a world who desperately need to know you? In Jesus' name, amen.